Thank you. As you're all getting settled, again, this is A23-1022 in the matter of the appeal by Pond Early Childhood Family Development Center. As all parties are aware, counsel for the relator will have 15 minutes for their argument in chief. Counsel for respondent will have 15 minutes for their argument. And then finally, counsel for the appellant relator will have 5 minutes for rebuttal. Whenever you're ready, just approach the podium. The podium goes up and down, so please adjust it to your level and adjust the microphones to your level and just tell us who you are in a loud, clear voice, please. So counsel for the appellant relator, whenever you're ready, you may begin.
Thank you, Your Honors. May it please the court, Nancy Hilden here today on behalf of Pond Early Childhood Learning Center and their owner-operator, Parents in Community Action Head Start, which operates 4 sites in Hennepin County. I'd also like to point out my colleague, Natalia Madriga, who is in her final semester of law school right now. So.
Well, hopefully this won't scare you off.
I'll try not to scare. I'll jump right in here. The staff, families, and communities that are impacted by the decision the DHS made for this fine are very distressed and concerned about the reputational harm that this damaging fine for failing to initiate a background study puts and tarnishes them with. These people hold themselves at a very high standard. They have decades of years of experience adhering to these laws and abiding by them. And frankly, this IEP professional hired by the school district as an employee with parental approval on record does not need a background study check initiated by Pond or PICA. And the problem here is that everyone wants our children safe, right? And we want zealous oversight of child care across the state, but we can't tolerate overzealous oversight. And the problem is that when you start to unfurl this cycle of more and more background study checks, what we do is tend to have confusion about who is responsible, who you contact if there is ever a reason to remove a person from exposure to a child. Now, the violations that were alleged in the fine all point to the statutory provisions point to the section that gives 8 different categories of who a child care facility has to initiate a background study check for. And that is 245C.02 subdivision A. And I briefed this, and I think it's important to note to the court, though, that in the subdivision B of that same section, there are exclusions and exceptions. And in fact, when you have parental approval signed and on record at the site, you don't need any background study check for a person to have exposure and contact with that child. So I would say that 245C.02 gives us the clear, plain meaning guidelines, both in A and B, that should be the guiding statute in this case.
Does the record indicate whether the background study that the department wanted is any more comprehensive than the background study that had already been provided on the individual?
The background studies are consistent and the same. They require fingerprinting, and that's another problem with overzealousness. It's not just a matter of having extra double checks on people. It requires a fee. It requires a person who's already been fingerprinted to go in again. And if they are going and providing services as paraprofessionals, as speech therapists in multiple sites, are we going to really make them go in and get fingerprinted for every site where they're providing these services when there's an IEP signed by the parent? It just defies logic. Furthermore, and I'm glad you bring this up, because there's a backlog at DHS. So we are putting people in queue and backing that up by people who have already passed a background study check. So in this case, no background study check is required for this employee of the school district, but he did have a background study check, and he was qualified and was a safe person to be working with children. On the exit interview statute, you know, this was passed in whole in 2017, and there's a reason why this was put into place. There is huge value in having licensing inspectors go and see in person how a child care facility is actually operating, what struggles they might be having, and to help provide that technical assistance and occasionally issue fines for things that are egregious, right? And understanding and creating that collaboration is really important. But the reason I believe that this was passed into law in 2017 is because it gives the providers finality. It allows licensees to know what to expect. It requires the agency to have some formality around these exit interviews and to be clear and to be very methodical. And it does require agencies to provide technical assistance. Now, the respondent argues that technical assistance was provided in this purported second interview of the phone call. Well, let's look at those two in quote-unquote. I really disagree profoundly with this phone call being an exit interview. So the formality was held with this first interview on-site with the people involved, with the director of the center. It was recorded. It was initiated with a time and a date and identifying everybody present. Everyone knew they were being recorded, and it was ended. And in the second hearing, my clients, three who were in that hearing, all testified that that exit interview ended as it always ends, with Ms. Ballinger saying, "This concludes this exit interview."
What if, for the sake of argument, there hadn't been a background study check at all? And same circumstances occur. And then she calls you later and says, "Hey, just one more thing. Has there been a background study completed on this individual?"
Great question.
Could you have said, "The interview's over, don't have to tell you, click"?
Great question. You know what? The authority of the DHS licensing department is very broad. They can go in unannounced at any time and conduct an inspection at any time. So the attempts...
If it's so broad, why can't they call you back and say, did you get is there a background study on the individual?
Well, but they have to follow what the 2017 statute requires, and that clearly didn't happen. They didn't, you know, just to underscore this, they're conducting this inspection of a licensed facility, one. And if that second interview was really a second interview, the director of that licensed facility, Duchess Anderson, was not even included in that second interview. There was technical assistance, quote unquote. How come the director of that licensed facility is not receiving that technical assistance? I think there's just a clear attempt here to try to shoehorn in something that this law clearly is trying to prevent from happening.
Does the provisions of the law that talk about the exit interview set forth a specific procedure like you've described here that was done in the first one? I mean, does the law require that?
It doesn't articulate a specific procedure. But I would argue that the fact that it was put in whole cloth is trying to give a clear guidance to the agency that you got to take this seriously. And the department should be held to the very formal standards of, okay, we're being told to conduct an exit interview, and the consequence of not bringing up an issue in that exit interview is that the commissioner shall not issue a correction order or negative licensing action for violations of law or rule not discussed in the exit interview. Having said that, I believe that 245C.02 obviates this because there was no law broken. There was no violation. You know, the other thing that I noticed was argued in the respondent's brief is just that DST, the paraprofessional, was affiliated with Pond. And that's simply, we simply beg to disagree. And affiliation is a very specific term used in the statutes that this licensing inspector was responsible for.
Was it defined in the statute?
Yeah, in under 245C07, basically says that study subjects affiliated with multiple
The term affiliated defined in the statute.
No.
I know it's study subjects.
Right, yeah. Right, correct. It's not.
And the reason I asked this question in my previous one gets to a technical appellate law issue in terms of what our standard of review is.
Right.
And when we look at these agency cases, for these types of, if there are undefined terms, oftentimes the court defers to the agency's interpretation as long as it's reasonable. So that's why I'm asking if there's a specific definitional violation that you can point to on the term affiliated. Otherwise, it changes the way we have to analyze the issue.
Well, thank you. I would simply say that to step back from the de novo review and analysis of the term, to step back and examine why this section of law is in place at all, it's because it provides efficiency of background checks. It allows one background study check to be applied to all affiliated centers, right? So there was an attempt by the legislature to create efficiencies, not to create this blossoming number of background study checks. We want efficiency. We want to have a clear line of access if a person has to be removed. We're not trying to just go out and double background check or triple background check or quadruple background check. Paraprofessionals. Doesn't help anybody. And I would argue it creates chaos. I guess I just want to argue once again, and this is in my closing.
Well, before you close, I have another issue.
Okay.
And it's been briefed by both parties here, and it's one that I'm very interested in. And it's the recent Supreme Court decision that says the commissioner had no remand authority here.
Yeah.
There was a final order,
right,
and there was no remand authority, and so they didn't have the statutory authority to do this. I mean, that's how the issue's been briefed and opposed by each side here.
Yeah.
To me, if that's the case, we don't get to most of what you've argued here today, because that would be a dispositive issue in this matter without addressing these other issues you've talked about.
Right. Well,
I'm wondering what your thoughts are about that.
Yeah.
Obviously.
So my hope is that, and we all know what that clear guidance is, right? My hope is that just like the ALJ in both instances considered the merits of the case to dispose of this fine, my hope is that you would consider the merits to provide direction to the agency, because right now there are paraprofessionals working with child care providers in every county of this state, and we need direction. We need to have...
Yeah, I'm sorry to interrupt you, but how does that give you direction if the commissioner has the ultimate authority to reject or modify the ALJ's decision? I mean, my question is, did we even have to get this far? The commissioner could have said, all right, I've seen either the first order or the second. There wasn't a default, and the fine was properly imposed. End of story. That's my decision as the commissioner. They have the authority under the statute to do that. That would be a separate appellate issue, obviously. But I guess I don't understand how it would provide guidance for us to address all of the issues that you've talked about here, which are valid issues, when the commissioner at the end of the day can reject that and say, that's how you would get finality. That's how you would get answered.
Thank you, Your Honor.
You know?
So just like the 20 October 23 case, the Supreme Court directed the agency and made it clear that they don't have unfettered discretion. Mm-hmm. They have to follow the plain language and the intent of the law. And I would say that the plain language and the intent of these laws clearly does not dictate a background study fine. The plain language. And so I think that the nice thing about that recent case law is it is giving direction to the agency. You got to follow the laws. You got to go back and review what those laws all actually require. And then finally, ultimately, what we need is we need these licensing inspectors to be working in collaboration. Everyone wants our children safe. Everyone. And we need to find better ways to not put people in a punitive posture within their communities for something that they didn't actually violate the law doing. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Haldeman. We'll now hear from counsel for the respondent, please.
Good morning, Your Honors. Please let me know if you have difficulty hearing me through the mask. May it please the court, my name is Morgan Alexander. I am an Assistant Attorney General representing the respondent, the Commissioner of the Minnesota Department of Human Services. This case concerns first whether the Commissioner properly affirmed the department's order to pay a fine for a background studies violation. Because there is substantial evidence in the record showing that relator allowed an individual to have unsupervised contact with a child before initiating a background study check on that individual, they violated the background study statute. And because the record supports a conclusion that relator was given an exit interview prior to the department issuing a sanction, the commissioner acted reasonably when she affirmed the order to pay a fine. As Judge Flory noted, this case also concerns whether the commissioner properly rejected the ALJ's default recommendation. And I recognize that relator has raised for the first time now on appeal the added question of whether the commissioner was permitted to order a hearing on the merits after rejecting the ALJ's default recommendation. The record supports the commissioner's finding that counsel for the department did not fail to appear at the hearing, and the commissioner acted within her authority when she subsequently ordered a hearing on the merits to address the legal questions at issue.
Well, that's a remand, correct?
Yes, Your Honor. In this case,
Ms. Alexander, you know, we're an intermediate court of appeals. We have to follow Supreme Court authority. In the Sears case, the Supreme Court said, we conclude that Section 14.62 Subdivision 2A provides the agency with three options after receiving the ALJ's report with recommendations: to accept the ALJ's report as the agency's final decision, to modify the ALJ's report, or to reject the ALJ's report. A remand is not a rejection. The option to remand is not permitted. Why are we here?
Well, Your Honor, this case is very distinguishable from Trinity. First, as the record shows, in Trinity, they had a full hearing on the merits, after which the commissioner remanded the case to the ALJ to make further factual findings. In this case, the ALJ brought the default recommendation before any hearing on the merits had occurred. The statute allows...
The ALJ said in the first order that there was no merit to the commissioner's claim.
He did subsequently say in the alternative...
And he said it in the second order, too.
In the second order, certainly. But in that first order, what he issued was a recommendation for default. The ALJ has the authority to recommend that, but the commissioner is not required to affirm that recommendation. She has the right to reject, and she did so in this case.
I mean, Ms. Alexander, aren't the issues that were presented are clearly a matter of law? There was no dispute that there was a background study. It's just not the one you all wanted. And it's either the statute governs And then, you know, I think we can all apply common sense as to what an exit interview is. I mean, why, following up on Judge Flory's excellent question, it seems to me the commissioner could have just rejected it and said, nope, you're wrong, you know, we win. Or you know, the ALJ got it wrong. I don't see how either it was necessary for a remand or that a remand was permitted under the law, even if there was no contested evidentiary hearing to begin with, which I understand is your key distinction.
Sure, so I'll take those part by part. So going to the contested case issue, you know, if we have a situation where an ALJ can recommend default, or they can recommend, let's say, granting a motion for summary disposition, and we acknowledge in the statute that the commissioner is permitted to reject those, and let's say we have an issue here where the commissioner wanted a more complete record, let's say she finds that there is a issue of material fact that needs to be sorted out.
But were there any issues of material fact in this case?
In this case, you know, the commissioner, in her order rejecting the ALJ, sent it back for a complete record to be made. You know, not all the exhibits had been offered. There wasn't an opportunity for witnesses to testify. So she did send it back. She used her authority to reject, and she did so. I will note, if this court determines that this is a hard line, the relator did not appeal. That order from the commissioner said there were 60 days to appeal. The relator did not do so. I'm going to take a sip of water, Your Honor. Apologies. She had 60 days to appeal. They did not do so. And the case continued to a hearing on the merits. You know, you can't unring that bell. As to the factual issues in this case, if we look to the commissioner's second order, where she did go through the facts, she determined first that there was a violation of the background study. I'll note that relator cites to this subpart B, but subpart B does not apply in this case. In addition to parental consent, the child needs to be signed out of the child care program. They need parental consent. They need, the relator needed to have documentation on site identifying the individual service provider. And they needed to ensure that the service provider did not have unsupervised access to other children not receiving the services. That was not the case here, as the facts show. This was an individual who
But none of that's in dispute, right?
No, none of that's in dispute. The undisputed facts show that relator was providing child care services in a classroom to relator's children. This individual was there reading to the children, doing art projects with them, just generally participating in the classroom. That individual took a child receiving relator services to the bathroom. He was unsupervised while doing so, and relator never initiated a background study. None of those facts are in dispute, and they all show under the statute that for that unsupervised contact to occur, relator needed to have initiated a background study. They did not do so. As a result...
So in looking for the reasons why you need, you know, the background study that you believe you require, the main practical understanding I had was, well, you know, with ours, it's that way it's easy accessible under our roster. And so it's easy to, you know, and fair enough, you know, I get that. But, you know, then as we always try to tell our clerks and former clerks, you know, we also do like to apply common sense in an appellate land where we are. And it's sort of like, you know, if there was a background study done, and if, well, first of all, do you agree that the substance of the background studies, there was nothing more that the one you were asking for would have added to than the one that has already been done? Is that a fair statement?
I believe they were both the similar.
Right. So the fingerprints, studies. the you know, the criminal background check, the, you know, the blah blah blah. What I'm having an understanding is why the inspector just didn't say, okay, well, would you email me your background study so that I can just see, you know, that, you know, here's our background study, here's yours, now I'm going to go through it line by line, and by God, you know, if we ask for one more thing that you don't ask for, you know, you're toast. I'm at a loss to understand... As part of the argument about what you're supposed to do in the exit interview and sort of give technical advice, you know, why that wasn't done. And it's like, okay, well, you know, I get it, but next time we have to do it because it's our roster and it's easier and we don't want to fall in the cracks because rosters take time. You know, I mean, who knows how long background studies, you know, get to the roster and then, you know, it could be like not on the roster and, you know, by God, it, he is a child molester and, you know, off we go. But that was not the case here, so I'm at a loss to understand why that sort of technical advice at the exit interview wasn't provided, Ms. Alexander.
So, first, just generally, the statute doesn't make exceptions for a situation like this. The statute is clear. As the technical assistance that was provided...
I had 50 background checks done by every state in the union and every county in the union. Is it your position that, well, by God, do another one because this is what it says?
Well, in this situation, Your Honor, the only issue that came up was when that individual was unsupervised. As long as that individual continued to be supervised while the child was receiving PON services, there was no violation of the background study. And that was the technical assistance that was provided numerous times to Relator. There was no issue up until the moment that that individual took the child out of the classroom. And, you know, there's... The policy reason here is organizations like Relator, they are required to initiate these background studies because if that individual does commit maltreatment against a child and is disqualified from providing further care, the department needs to be able to immediately contact all organizations who are linked to that individual to inform them of the individual's disqualification. Nothing in the statute allows the department to delegate that responsibility to, for instance, Bloomington Public Schools. All PON had to do was ensure that that individual was not did not have unsupervised access with a child. You ask about the providing of a background study. The licensor did reach out, as these emails show. They reached out. They asked if he was on the roster. They received a letter from Bloomington simply saying this individual is employed by our school. It did take Relator 10 days to actually be able to provide the licensor with a background study on that individual. So not only had they not conducted a background study, they also didn't even have a background study on site on the premises at the time this occurred.
Is that required under the statute, that it's got to be on site?
No, Your Honor, just okay. To note.
I get it.
We'll briefly address... They brought up affiliated earlier. The statute that the relator is mentioning, it just doesn't connect with this statute. That is relating to an organization like PICA that has facilities like POND and others. Individuals can work at those other centers and be affiliated. That is a different relationship than what POND has with Bloomington Public Schools. To briefly acknowledge the exit interview, as we've discussed, technical assistance was provided. The statute says that there must be technical assistance on how to comply with applicable laws and rules. The record is replete with these instances. There were multiple emails. There was this phone call that explained the issue was this unsupervised contact. And that's all that's required. There was a violation found. The technical assistance was given on how to avoid a violation like this happening in future. The statute calls for a $200 fine. That is a small fine, and it is a fine that ensures an issue doesn't happen again.
You're right. Well, actually, I think $200 is a lot of money, but whatever. You know, I have three kids. But, you know, you get a fine like this, and there's all sorts of ramifications. So it's not just, oh, well, you know, pay the $200 and, you know, get out of my sight. I mean, is that a fair statement? I mean, this institution could be in jeopardy for all sorts of future funding, you know, blah, blah, blah. Maybe you have to publish it, et cetera, et cetera. I mean, this is a big to-do, right?
The $200 fine is listed on the DHS website. As to whether it impacts funding,
and
that's
so naturally, everyone wants to go to a family development center that's been fined by the DHS. Boy, I can't wait to sign me up for that, right? No one's going to want that.
I think these kinds of, you know, violations, they are put on the website as is required. Centers have violations. They make
and
these mistakes.
And does it say violation for not complying with a statute and getting a background study? Is that what it say?
It states what the violation is, yes. I mean, there are several different violations that range from sanctions of $200 up to a conditional license, up to a revocation license. The role of the Department of Human Services is to follow the statute when it sees a violation. To point this out, they issued the fine as they were required to. It was put on the website as it is meant to. And that is what happened here. That is not outside what is the norm and what is appropriate under the statute. I know I have just a few minutes remaining. I would note that agency decisions enjoy a presumption of correctness. The commissioner's order and the attached memorandum gives a clear explanation based on the substantial evidence in the record that was presented at the hearing on the merits that relator violated the background study statute and that they were afforded an exit interview prior to the issuance of the sanction. As such, this court should affirm the commissioner's order affirming the order to pay a fine for a background studies violation. And unless there are other questions, I will yield my time.
Thank you, Ms. Alexander.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Counsel for the appellant relator, you'll have 5 minutes for rebuttal, please.
I won't need that, Your Honor.
First of all, I just want to say, we did not appeal a remand. My analysis of that moment in time was that it wasn't a final decision allowing me to make any kind of appeal at that time. And now I think we have clear guidance from the Supreme Court on what that remand offered. Secondly, it is inaccurate, and we vociferously deny that this person had unsupervised access with any child, except for that person that he was assigned to. No unsupervised access with any child in that classroom. Now, are we going to punish Pond for working collaboratively with schools to make sure that these children with special needs are integrated into reading time and play time with other children? There was supervision in that classroom. This individual, this paraprofessional, actually didn't take that child out of the classroom. The facts aren't, beyond that, I can't share the facts because it's not in the record, but there is no evidence that this individual took this child out of the classroom. It didn't happen. So we got to follow the rules. We got to follow the law. And we can't just make stuff up. And that's another reason why it's important to have these inspections in person. They have to see what's going on and talk to these providers and understand what is happening in these classrooms to be able to help guide them if they aren't doing something right. In this case, my client followed the letter of the law. Now, please look at 245C02 paren B. There is no background study required. And this idea that there's 10 days required, or that they took 10 days, we didn't have the background study on my client's site. Wasn't necessary. Wasn't required under the law. And they knew it. They looked it up. Ms. Ballinger looked that up and knew that this individual had a background study right away. So we're arguing about angels on the heads of pins here. We need this system to be effective and efficient and protect our children and not create confusion or chaos. And I will just let you look at I'm not even going to go into the affiliated statute, 245C07. It lays out what that means for this area of law. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Heildon. Thank you, Ms. Alexander. The matter was well argued and well briefed. We appreciate the seriousness of the matter that is from the viewpoint of both the Pond Early Child Family Development Center and the Department of Human Services. We'll issue our opinion in 90 days. How are you feeling, Ms. Alexander? Good. We appreciate your willingness to come. As you can see, it would have been difficult to do this by all the reasons that are in the courtroom. But we wish you well. It was a pleasure to see you again. I will give your warmest regards to Judge Larkin. With that matter, we will move on to the next case. Thank you all for coming.